Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you once again to do a little talking about what's going on in the pop culture world and, of course, around popdose.com. And Rob Ross, we're trying something a little bit new this week. You sound much closer.
I do, don't I? I sound like I'm actually in the room, but through the magnificent technology that we call Skype.
That's right.
We're able to actually sound like we're sitting side by side doing a show together.
The interwebs are an amazing thing. And how's your week been so far? Everything going okay?
So far, so good. No complaints. You know, those goddamn Rangers, just when I'm ready to throw in the fucking towel and raise holy hell because they're going to get slaughtered by – oh, wait, they didn't get slaughtered by the Habs. They took them out in six.
Yep.
Yay, the Rangers are going on to the next round, so they'll lose to the Senators.
Yeah, and of course, over here in the Western Conference, we've got the Nashville Predators taking on the St. Louis Blues, which means my sons hate each other for the next 10 days. So this is great. We've got the Civil War, brother fighting against brother once again, but this too shall pass. So
and you abstaining courteously because you are, of course, by nature, a Buffalo Sabres fan,
right, which means I don't even know what the playoffs are anymore. So just take that for whatever it's worth, but we have a whole bunch to go over, and of course, both of our weeks are going much better than that of Bill O'Reilly or Jason Chaffetz. So let's start with the former, because you know, as much as we say that, the dude was just handed a check for $25 million, so I guess things could be worse, but still, he won't stop. I mean, the latest news on this again is Bill O'Reilly says the truth will come out someday. Fuck off.
Well, first of all, he's now doing a podcast, apparently.
Yeah.
Wow. Shock, horror.
Mm-hmm.
Stop the presses. Alert the media.
Right.
Who gives a fuck about Bill O'Reilly's podcast?
Yeah, and he's making people pay for it. Just like $5 to subscribe to the thing or whatever it is.
We're free and we're on for at least an hour now. Yeah. Free. Come to us. I don't care if you're a Republican or Democrat.
Right.
Your money is the same because we ain't getting paid.
Exactly. That's
Bill O'Reilly is what you know. He's such a charlatan, and he always has been. But
right.
The fact that he's standing there with all of these people who have said, without question or fail, yes, he is guilty of sexual harassment. It doesn't need to go to trial. It doesn't need to go before a jury. And he's still he's basically shouting at the rain saying, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. No, you're not. You're a fucking liar is
right.
What you are. You've always been a liar, and you will always be a liar. You know, just take your $25 million and go buy yourself a fucking falafel cart.
Exactly. And that's the thing is, you know, what this really is, the lesson from this is that if you contribute to an atmosphere of sexual harassment and racism and bad feelings in a hostile work environment for years and years and decades, your punishment for that is a check for $25 million. I mean, come on, there's got to be a better way.
Well, maybe we should look into a different avenue then.
Yeah, really? I'm in the wrong line of work.
Where have we gone wrong?
I don't know. But on the other side of that coin is Jason Chaffetz. And this one, I understand less and less. I mean, you know, now he's turning on Donald Trump, kind of, or at least turning on the former, whoever he was, the general who screwed Flynn. He's turning on Flynn. And, you know, by extension, and then, you know, turning around right after that and saying, yeah, well, you know, I'm not going to run again. And now there's rumors swirling he may quit before the end of his term. Who knows what's going to go on with this guy?
Well, there's a couple of things about Chaffetz. Let's remember, he's the guy who had the first major hard-on for going after Hillary again during the campaign,
yep,
which set off Comey.
Right.
And him barking, being the, you know, him being the pillar of, you know, the bastion of morality in all of this. But now it comes out, and part of it seems to have come out simultaneously with him suddenly announcing that he was not going to be running for re-election. But he said it in a way that makes you think, well, he may not run for re-election now. He may run for a different office, maybe in 2020.
Yeah.
Maybe he's got an eye on that. But this comes just as there is now talk of, wait a minute, Chaffetz has had some kind of business dealings or some kind of dealings with Russia.
Right.
And this is where it gets really – it gets even more sinister and even more questionable.
Right, because how eager is he now to flip on Flynn when maybe what he's trying to do is deflect the attention away from himself?
Exactly is what I think he's doing. That's – you're absolutely correct. And I think that sooner than later, like everything else, because especially in politics, you can't hide anything. You just can't. It's going to come out. Now, whether or not it's going to hopefully harm him and end his political career, one can only hope. I would love to see him behind bars just as well, because I think he's equally culpable in the treasonous act of trying to rig an election.
Yep.
Now, having said that, he's a fucking hypocrite and he's a liar, and all I can say is that I am hoping, against hope, of course, that there is enough evidence available that at least he will topple too. I mean, so of course, you and I have talked about it ad infinitum. Where's the smoking gun as of yet on Trump? Well, at least let's take out all these little players. Let's take out Chaffetz. Let's take out Comey. Let's get rid of all of these who helped put him there.
Right, and that's the thing is eventually, like you said, the truth will out, and there will be a moment where all of this, where the pins underpinning all of this are just going to be kicked out one by one, and finally it's going to fall over. So I guess at that point, if Bill O'Reilly's going to be running his falafel cart, Chaffetz also always has the Hair Club for Men franchise he should have opened years ago. Because I'm sorry, what I don't know what this is up here. It's
That
like.
is some kind of 1980s locked in place, a lot of Aquanet in the white can holding that awful toupe.
Every time I see him, I think of Slapshot with Jim Carr. Why do you wear that awful rug?
Well, you know what? You call Cy Sperling, since he's not only the president, but he's a
He's
member.
also a member. Yeah, exactly. So, there is a future for all of them. And of course, on the Democratic side, your favorite, personally, Bernie Sanders showed up again
And
this
before we
week.
talk about Bernie Sanders, let me just say one more thing about the Republicans, okay? Now, hang on a second. I got to wipe the drool from my mouth because I spit every time I talk. All right, listen to me. Let's talk about Sean Hannity for a minute. Now, there's a guy who's now being accused of sexual harassment, too.
Yep.
That fuse has been lit. You're going to tell me that there isn't something there? It seems to be part of the Fox News culture. There was a clip yesterday of some program where the guests were sexually harassing one of the
Yep.
hosts. Come on, I'm more than certain that Hannity is the next to get the
Oh
axe.
yeah. Well, it's the boys club mentality. I mean, you've got not only have you got Bill O'Reilly and you got Roger Ailes and of course Allison Camerota, who now works at CNN, just yesterday or the day before came out and said, "Oh yeah, Roger Ailes sexually harassed me too and asked me to come up to the hotel room to get a, ahead in my job." And now the allegations start to swirl around about Hannity, and what does it point to other than a bunch of guys who did nothing but go out and drink together and then play grab ass with everybody they could inside the halls of Fox News Channel.
Exactly. Now, to get back to my favorite topic, Bernie Sanders. Okay. What do we want to talk about Bernie? The fact that he's Saint Bernard?
Yeah.
The fact that he's got all these millions that, well, I don't know where the money went. You have to ask my wife.
Right. And still, the love affair continues because they keep looking at him going, well, he sure energized all those young people who didn't vote in the general election.
Right. He energized young people to simply be angry and mistrustful, distrustful,
Either way.
not trusting the Democratic Party. Oh, and by the way, as it's a fact, he joined the party for convenience so he could run on the ticket against Hillary Clinton and then quit the day after the elections. Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat, and yet there he is, extolling his virtues of what he thinks is supposed to be the Democratic Party under his stewardship.
Yeah.
And all of this has made a greater division, especially in terms of this upcoming election runoff in Georgia. And I'm sorry, but he's got to go. He's got to be stopped. The Democratic Party, in and of itself, has gotten more than enough problems. They're directionless. They are truly out of touch. There's no arguing that. But they have nobody that I can think of, except for, as you and I have stated, and maybe a few others, the hope and possibility would be with Cory Booker.
Right.
He hasn't stepped up to that job yet, but can he? Should he? Wouldn't you think for someone who may be groomed to run for the presidency in 2020, he'd want to stay away from that? Let
Yeah.
somebody else do the actual shaping and molding and pointing the direction of the party, so that way when the time comes, you bring in the chosen candidate and put it in place.
Right. And that time coming is an interesting thing to look at because if, and there's a lot of ifs involved in this. the Democrats have an opportunity 2 years down the road, a little less than 2 years down the road now, to make some inroads in Congress and do something important. If that doesn't happen, it makes a 2020 run more difficult, no matter if Donald Trump runs again or not. But if you're Cory Booker, do you really want to take a chance of trying to topple Donald Trump and failing? Because if you do, it's over. You're done.
And also right now, do you want to try and take the chance of, I hate to say it, toppling Bernie Sanders?
Right. Yeah, and exactly. In 8 years from now, Bernie's not going to be a factor. So there's a lot going on. But like you said, I mean, it's got to be, all eyes have to be focused on 2018 rather, and trying to make things happen in Congress. Because unless you can do what the Republicans did to Barack Obama in the second year of his presidency in 2010, and kick the whatever support he still has in Congress out from underneath him, then you're going to have two more years where he's still got a majority. But of course, he's had 100 days with a majority. He's done nothing but piss it away. So
exactly. I mean, well, first of all, you're right about keeping the eye on 2020 and 2018. The thing is by having somebody like Sanders going in there with his fucking rally of absolute pointlessness,
right,
except to continue to point the fingers and say, you know, who's to blame for this? And I would have won, which is a complete fallacy,
mm-hmm.
just a factual fallacy. You need to have somebody to give that party direction, to unify it and give it direction. If these people who are so behind Bernie Sanders want to stay behind him, go right ahead. But you're not going to be part of the Democratic Party going forward. The Democratic Party really needs to reshape itself. And maybe that means cutting out some of the cancers that have seemingly grown within.
Yep.
Having said that, somebody like Ossoff is a very good example of what could possibly be one of those first topplers, one of the first dominoes to start knocking the other dominoes down.
Right.
But you can't have somebody like Sanders interfering in this. He has got to go away, and he's got to go away now.
Right, so that there can be a refocusing.
Yeah, he's going to hurt this runoff campaign in, what is it, June?
Yes, right. Yeah, just a couple of months down the road.
Yeah, so this has to change, and it has to change dramatically. And now, in the meantime, after 100 days, Trump has not only pissed away his complete carte blanche, if you will, of having a completely Republican House and Senate, he's threatening to shut down the government.
Over the wall. And I mean, he backed off of the wall thing, but still, I want somebody to ask him the question. You got all these billions of dollars. You're asking Congress for $1.7 billion. If you're so sure Mexico's going to pay you back, why don't you put up the money, you schmuck?
Right. Right. I mean, you can write it off in taxes later on.
Yeah, right.
Or do you not do your taxes? But even that, the whole thing with shutting down the government, can you think of a time historically when a sitting president had both houses and, in fact, shut the government down anyway?
No, never. Not even close. So, and especially after 100 days, it's insanity. And yet, you know, the polls that came out this week said the base is still behind him, because he was right when he said he could walk down Fifth Avenue, plug a bullet into somebody's head, and those people would still support him.
Yep. And I believe it. I believe he said it. And I don't think for 1 minute that he doesn't believe anything that he says.
Right.
You know, he does believe his own bullshit. I mean, my God, the callousness of saying, I've gotten the highest rating since 9/11?
Yeah, I know.
Are you for real?
And they're not incensed.
That's a rhetorical question. That is, yeah, I mean, he said it.
Right. Right. And they don't care, you know, all of the phony outrage and all of the bullshit of the last 8 years of every, oh, he saluted with a cup of coffee in his hand. Shut up.
Oh, the moral outrage of this country is an amazing thing.
It is.
Well, on both sides, because you know how much I love, you know, those virtue signaling social justice warriors of the left as well.
Oh, as long as they've got their safe spaces, they're fine.
Ah, yes, in their safe space.
Rob Ross and John Grayson, it's Radio City. And as we leave the world of politics behind, gladly so, we do have some things to talk about in the pop culture world, because, of course, Popdose keeps track of all of it. Television is a world that we don't delve into a whole heck of a lot. But, you know, I finally got the new Mystery Science Theater 3000 episodes. I've watched about half of them. They're outstanding. The Americans this season has finally started to pick up a little bit again. Boy, it was at a slow start.
Yeah.
But some things are are starting to happen there. And now we're starting to get a lot of series back, and some of them at least back for their last season. So what are you looking at?
Well, we just said goodbye to a show that we never really talked about much, but one that I enjoyed by and large during its run was Bates Motel.
Yeah.
Which was the, I guess, the prequel really to the Psycho movies. Very well done series. It was set in modern times, which I like the fact that they retooled it to work in that manner. Final episode aired last night. A surprise ending, I will grant you, because I didn't see it coming. But I thought overall this is a show that will be missed because it was just so well done. You know, there was a sense of humor in it, as dark as that may be.
Mm-hmm.
It was creepy. It was suspenseful. It kept you watching. And that's the sign of any good TV series. It kept you coming back. On the flip side, I couldn't be happier than that pile of shit known as Girls is finally. Man, I want to slap Judd Apatow for ever giving the world Lena Dunham.
Yeah.
Talk about a no-talent gadfly who, I don't know how, she suddenly became the arbiter of everything, including art and social commentary. Just what a no-talent and... God, what an irritating human being. Go away with that boyfriend of yours from that god-awful band Fun and fuck off.
Yeah.
All that gone.
Yeah, and, you know, that was one that had, I think, some, I'm not going to say promise, but at least there was reason after the first couple of episodes to go, maybe something interesting is going to happen here. And then for 8 years, it didn't.
The only thing it had going for it is that Adam Driver was a regular. And
yeah.
He's gone on to bigger and better, and we can all just love him and hate him simultaneously as Kylo Ren.
There you go. It.
The rest, no, just take, you know, Sex and the City and go away.
Yep.
Okay, just have done with it.
Now, Silicon Valley is another one you picked out.
Yeah.
And in Silicon Valley, as a guy, I watched at the behest of my eldest son, the IT Crowd. And that served as such a great primer for what they were going after in Silicon Valley. And that show, as it got older, it aged very well, and the cast widened out very well, and they brought in talented people. It was just, it's been great.
Silicon Valley is a smart, incredibly real kind of show. You know, I worked, this is going back a decade and change, but I worked at a tech firm.
Yeah.
And I could picture my coworkers gathering around on off hours saying exactly what these guys are saying. Not getting high, but they were definitely saying the same kinds of things. And the reality factor for once is a nice, it's a great reminder of, yeah, I've heard these conversations. And they're just as funny seeing it on screen being played by these guys who are incredibly talented. That's a great, great crop of comedic genius all in one little space. And let's face it, it was written and created by Mike Judge. And Mike Judge still has it. He's an astute, I would call him a visionary, actually. He's a magnificent social critic.
No doubt.
He has, you know, I mean, from Silicon Valley, certainly to, of course, now Idiocracy, which has made this phenomenal comeback as being looked upon as, dare I say it, a prophecy. Because I even said this is where we're heading.
Yeah.
And, of course, Office Space.
Right.
Some Butthead aside, but I mean Office Space and of course, what do you call it? King of the Hill. Now, of course, the season ender of, and it's been a couple of weeks now, but still we have to talk about the season ender of The Walking Dead because that is the most popular show on television, bar none. And once again, fantastic surprise ending. The last, you know, because they do these staggered seasons where they split it. The last two season enders were kind of, they were supposed to be cliffhangers, but instead they just kind of took a meh path.
Right, yeah.
This one finally regained some balls. No, strike that. It had hairy balls, and I like that. I like the fact that they brought some meat into it, you know, so that's another one. And the return of Veep, which is possibly the most hysterical, hateful show I've ever watched on television. The writing is absolutely dynamic. I've never been a fan of Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but she is absolutely magnificent in this role. And everybody with her is equal.
Yeah.
They are just so hate-filled, despicable, foul-mouthed, And I'm fairly certain, even though it's a comedy as close to the reality of day-to-day politics in Washington, D.C. as you will get.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, the writing has been stellar. And there's another one that didn't falter. And that's the biggest thing. You know, we were having a conversation, me and a couple of friends, about the fact that of all of the things that the internet has given us, the one thing that it seems to have taken away is water cooler television. There isn't any anymore. And part of it is because of the net, and part of it is simply because of the ability to binge watch stuff now, that nobody watches things at the same rate. Nobody watches things at the same time. There's never people coming back to work on Monday morning or Wednesday morning or Thursday morning after seeing the big show last night, because half of you haven't gotten to it, and then you have to listen to people whine and bitch about spoiler.
It's true. You know, we don't have water cooler TV. We don't have, water cooler moments like, hey, did you happen to see Big Star on The Tonight Show last night?
Right.
People don't talk about, did you hear what Howard Stern said this morning on the radio?
Yeah.
None of that. It's true. It's another, strangely enough, lost art. It takes away from the art of conversation and really, I know it sounds very base, but socializing.
Yeah. Right. Just for socializing's sake, because who really cares who shot JR in the long run? But it means something to be able to get together and to connect with people on that level, on something that shows that you have a communal experience with somebody, even if you only ever see them at work.
Well, first of all, I always thought Dusty shot JR. I didn't remember, but it was Kristen who did it. But that's just my, hey, I'm from that era. I watched it,
Yep.
but I also tuned into the final episode of MASH, by which time I was wishing they would put that dog down.
Oh, man. Yeah. How
Because,
about a TV show that lasted 5.5 times longer than the war did?
oh my God, longer than both Korea and Vietnam, for Christ's sakes. I mean,
Ugh.
MASH debuted when Vietnam was still happening, but I just remember after Gary Berghoff had left, and at that point, the show had already gone as far as I think it could have gone, and it started to get precious. And Radar became a really minor and very irritating character anyway. And the way it limped along for those last 3.5 seasons was just god awful. In
Yeah.
fact, I swear to you, John, I think the last episode I may have watched was the episode right after Goodbye Radar, which was a follow-up episode where they, the Radar goes home and is mistaken by BJ's daughter for being BJ, and Klinger's taking a lot of flack for not being as good of a company clerk as Radar, so BJ and Klinger go on this mad drinking binge. And I just thought, yeah, you know what? You lost me.
Yep.
You lost me. So TV shows really, like many bands do, have a short shelf life. I say you get 5, 6 years tops out of them. You get their best work, and then you can tell when they start to decline. That's when you really should just do the smart thing and pull the plug.
Yeah.
There have been a couple of series, and you mentioned one of them earlier, that have already laid out the perimeters of when they're going to end. The Americans is going to end after next season.
Right.
That'll be it. Forgot which is the other one that has 2 more years, and then they're calling it a day also, 2 more seasons, but I just can't think of it off the top of my head. I'm
No, but
sorry,
I
Will.
think that's smart to do, though, because you're giving people, you're telling them, listen, even if you're getting a little bit weary of this, stay with us. We're going to tell the end of this story.
And it's funny, I think when it gets closer and we're still both here doing this, I think we should throw into the hat what we think the logical end point for the Americans is going to be. Because I've got a couple of end scenarios,
Yeah.
alternative endings, but it's just one of those shows you can actually foresee it coming because it is in a particular historic time frame, and the subject matter does have a specific shelf life. So it's
So,
going to be one of two things.
right. And so the big question is, I mean, is leading into the final season when they get caught, or do they?
Or do they decide they want to stay in the United States?
And to
Because
assimilate, yeah.
by that point, well, first of all, Philip has obviously always had that feeling of being more now American than Russian.
Ever since he bought the Camaro, right?
Well, there was his midlife crisis.
Yep.
Second of all, by that time, Gorbachev should be in office because we are going in a pattern now.
Right,
It's
right.
1984, which means Andropov has to die during this season for Chernenko to come in. So, that's gonna shift things. and how they're going to approach the change of power yet again after having lost, what's his name, Brezhnev. Because don't forget, Russia went through three leaders in, what, a two-year span, three-year span?
Right,
so,
right.
I'm hoping, and I have some faith that the writers will pick up on what needs to be done to make this work the right way.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what: if they decide to make Stan turn into an informant for the Russians, I'm going to fire off an angry email.
All right, we'll be on the lookout for that. And as we turn another corner, you mentioned Big Star just a couple of minutes ago, and there was a Jeopardy question of which Big Star was the answer just a night or two ago, and I thought that was interesting to see, a little love for the Big Star gang. But that's not the only thing. There's a huge piece of consumptive material now that's out for fans of Big Star. What do we have?
It is a brand new 2-CD DVD or Blu-ray set that comes as one very beautiful package. Big Star's Third Live. It's called Big Star's Third, Thank You Friends, Live and More. This is a concert that was shot last year in Los Angeles, appropriately at a place called the Alex Theater. And it was another one of the all-star lineups of performers doing the Big Star Third album in its entirety. For this performance, though, they had amongst the luminaries, and there are luminaries, they had the Kronos Quartet leading the orchestral section. Carl Marsh, who actually wrote the original string scores for the third album and conducted the orchestra when it was recorded. People like Robin Hitchcock took part in this. Dan Wilson from Semisonic, Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, or one of his bandmates in Wilco. Pat Sansone has been a fair regular to these shows. And of course, the basic core of the Big Star Third Ensemble, led by Chris Stamey, Mitch Easter on guitar, Jody Stevens, naturally, Mike Mills on bass, Skylar Gudash, Django Haskins, and of course, Brett Harris, an amazing, and I'm probably understating it, an amazing performance, an amazing delivery of each one of the songs with an emotion conveyed like I've never seen before. Now, I've had the good fortune of seeing two of these performances. I saw one in 2013, just before you and I started working together. I saw them do this. It was one of the first performances, actually, in Central Park on an incredibly beautiful Sunday night. And I will get to that in a moment. But I also saw them do it in Washington, D.C. during the summer of 2014. And in that performance, they decided to do not only Big Star Third, but they did the entirety of Number One Record. So now you have both albums, plus, of course, the better-known songs off of Radio City and the Alex Chilton solo stuff and the Chris Bell solo stuff. But this performance, they melded everything together. So, and they took the best performances instead of putting each entire album's performance in this to give it a sense of continuity. And it works, because when Pat Sansone comes out and starts the show with I'm in Love with a Girl, which is actually from Radio City, he does it in such a joyful way that it ramps up a sense of happiness, you know, because it's not leading off with the third material, which is just very dark and very weird to begin with. And it doesn't start with the balls out rockiness of Feel. Feel actually is the second song performed, done by Ken Stringfellow of the Posies and Big Star. And, you know, since he always sang it when the reconstituted Big Star were out live, he did it. He just shredded and it sounded so good. And then third up was Mike Mills doing lead vocals on September Girls and knocking it out of the park. You start with that trifecta, you know it's going to be a great show. And I'm not sure how many people in the audience were really anticipating the whole build-up to the material from Third. You could just sit there and listen to those songs and go on to do any of the other songs from Number One Record or Radio City and, of course, Third. But the fact is, by starting with those three, you've already set the tone for just one of the most amazing performances. And I've got to single out a couple of things here. Jody Stevens' deliverance of both For You and Blue Moon, seriously, when you hear these two and you watch it, you just want to weep. They're both so incredibly from the heart and so pure and beautiful. It's just impossible to not be overtaken with emotion. And that's one of the most important things. It doesn't matter that it's Big Star in this case. When a song really gets you in its grips and it really reaches into you. And the same can be said when Jeff Tweedy sang Nighttime. Because, first of all, that is a very sad song. It's a very stark song, but it's an incredibly beautiful piece. And, of course, that line about, I hate it here, get me out of here. When he delivers it, it sounds like he's filled with this anger and pain. But at moments, when you close your eyes, he did sound like Alex Chilton. You know, and that's just another incredibly overpowering moment. The other two that were just heart stoppers was Django Haskins doing Holocaust and Brett Harris doing Kangaroo. Two of the most obtuse and darkest moments of the third album. And those two performances were perfect bookends, really.
Yeah.
Because they're such bleak pieces. I guess Kangaroo may have it may be the lighter of the two, but the way that they're delivered, whether it was the original versions or by these two incredibly talented gentlemen, there is just a shroud that comes over you. These are, again, songs that go through you like osmosis. They go into you. And I've seen both of them do these songs. But this particular one, this was, in essence, the perfect reading of the Big Star live show as it's been done. Because I have seen it where, of course, the great thing about live performance is somebody fucks up something somewhere. It could be a minor glitch. Like, every time I've seen them, Mike Mills, God love him, always manages to fuck up the verses of September Girls. He always manages to sing the second verse twice. You know, instead of singing it first verse, second verse, back to first verse. I mean, he got it dead perfect this time.
Yeah.
But everybody in this show was amazing. And I do mean amazing.
So this is obviously an essential, but you mentioned the show in Central Park.
Right. So the show in Central Park, this is, I got the call from a very dear friend who's now also a guest contributor to Pop Dos, Mr. Iman Labadetti, one of the most revered and respected writers in the rock pantheon. If you don't know who he is, I sure as fuck don't want to know you. You know nothing about rock journalism. I occasionally contribute to Rock NYC Live and Recorded, which is his online music service. And he said, would you like to see the Big Star third show at Central Park and write about it? And of course, I said, I would love to. I get there early, as is my usual thing. I asked the police who were there, you know, where do you line up? I need to go in and get my press credentials. Like, no problem, I'll go over there. So I'm waiting, and there's these two very nice women standing there waiting very patiently. And we strike up a conversation. And the older of the two women says to me, are you one of the musicians? I said, oh, no, I'm here, actually. I said, this is my first time as a credential-driven member of the rock press here to cover it. I said, but, you know, Big Star is one of my favorite bands, and the show is actually being directed by one of my favorite musicians of all time. And she goes, oh, who's that? And I said, Chris Stamey. And she goes, oh, that's funny. And I said, and she looks at me, and she goes, he's my husband. And, of course, the young lady standing next to her was their daughter.
Yeah.
So we were talking and talking, and we go in together, and that was very nice because it helped to kind of lessen the me being all uptight about going in to see the show and getting my credentials. And I go in, and there's, thank God, an area for the press to sit, and this wonderful young man is sitting there in front of me, and he's talking to this woman and talking to me, and he's like, oh, you're with the press? And I was like, yeah, and we're just having a very light conversation. And I said, I'm sorry, what's your name? He goes, my name is Brett Harris. I'm actually going to be playing with these guys. I said, just out of curiosity, how did you – he goes, well, I played guitar and keyboards with the DBs. I was like, holy shit, I saw you a couple of months ago in Hoboken. Oh, my God. And so that kind of forged a friendship there, which was a great feeling. But, you know, I got to kind of go around and say my hellos and pay my respects to Mike Mills and Mitch Easter and Marshall Crenshaw and so on and so forth. And that night, you know, they had called for rain. all day, and it was gray and cloudy when I left for Central Park. I kid you not, by the time that the crowd was coming in, it was beautiful. You
Yeah.
know, it was the last night of June. It was a Sunday night. It was gorgeous. The skies were slightly overcast, which I think was a very poetic kind of coloring for them performing Big Star Third. But they came out and they did the show, and there was a point they did the stuff from Number One Record and Radio City first. And then at a point, Chris Stamey said, "Okay, now we're going to do the third album." And you know, they took like a 5-minute break, came out and started to do it. And I got to tell you, I have never seen so many people in a concert at various points of the show crying.
Yeah, in tears,
Great.
sure.
Absolutely moved beyond description. More standing ovations than any show I've ever been to in my life. Seriously, you know, people, because, and the great thing was when you looked out on the lawn at Central Park, there were families there.
Yep.
You know, talking about young kids, that made me feel so good that parents were bringing their kids to see this. You know, it was a free concert, which made it all the more sweet. This wasn't one of those events that you had to line up for 6 hours and pay a phenomenal amount of money for. This was free. And to see all of these families, and it was a packed house. And by the time they got to the very end, they closed with "Thank You, Friends." Everybody was singing, like you could just hear the echoing of people singing along. And the very last number of the night was "The Letter."
Back
And
to the
you
box
saw
tops.
and heard everybody singing along. And you want to talk about a magic night, but that was also the start of Big Star Week in New York that week, because the movie was actually going to be playing, the documentary, Nothing Can Hurt Me, was going to be playing at the IFC Cinema as a special preview before the national opening, which was coming in a couple of weeks. So it was a really, really amazing week. You know, there was the previews, then there was the, you know, that week also included the opening night, which I got to go to, and I was so exhausted by the end of the actual premiere that even though I walked it, I was literally falling asleep on my feet. They were having an after premiere party at the old CBGBs at the John Varvatos store,
Yeah.
which basically was the core band was going to play, you know? And I just couldn't bring myself to go because I was falling asleep. I fell asleep on the ferry. But, you know, it was the memory of that show and then the show in DC when they opened up with Feel and went right into Number One Record and played it note for note in running order. You know, watching this DVD was just an overpowering thing in the best possible way. And if you're a fan of Big Star, and if you're, I mean, you could be a fan of anybody, but this will move you like
Good.
it moves anybody who is a fan of Big Star. And I think that is why it is indeed, as you said, essential viewing, essential listening. And it's a win because it's both DVD or Blu-ray and CD in one package.
Yep. So you can keep it in the car with you as well. That's terrific. And on that note, by the way, you mentioned rock journalism and knowing your stuff. And for people who do, and especially for people who are Beatle fans, I get to chime in here with a book recommendation because I had a conversation this morning with Rob Sheffield, longtime writer for Rolling Stone, and he's done, oh, I don't know how many books on rock and roll culture. His latest one is a Beatle book. It's called Dreaming the Beatles, and it goes through, you know, it goes not it's not a song by song reference, but it takes a lot of songs and tells the stories behind them, and not only the story about what went into the lyricism, but also the story behind what was happening with the band at the time and what was going on with the fans at the time. It's a really cool take, and it's one of those books that if rock journalism suffers from anything, it's that it either gets overly sentimental or it gets too dry and it starts to read like a history book. This one hits it right in that sweet spot where it's a very warm read. And if you're a fan of the band, and by the way, who isn't, you just it comes over you like putting on your favorite sweater. It's just a really cool book. So, Dreaming the Beatles by Rob Sheffield, one that you should definitely check out.
I like the idea of that because, as you and I talked about, it was probably about a year and change ago. the last book about the Beatles that I read that I actively liked was that book, Beatleness,
Yes.
by Candy Leonard, because it wasn't your typical Beatle book. It wasn't, you know, an overly zealous fan-based piece, and
Yep.
it wasn't a dry history. It was also a very different perspective. It was the Beatles for, you know, your feeling on the Beatles as they were happening, and it was taken from the fans' perspective at a time, and this is the most critical point of it,
Yeah.
when there weren't instant updates, where you didn't have the interwebs to give you everything. You had to wait for, you know, a song to be played on the radio. You didn't know that, oh, a new Beatle record is out until you heard it on the radio, or seeing something on the evening news, maybe, or finding a newspaper clipping. It wasn't instant gratification or getting a fix on, you know, the latest happenings with the fads.
Yeah, right. Well, and can you imagine, and part of this new book, part of Dreaming the Beatles, is the story of Dear Prudence. And the fact that, to give a roundabout description of this, when Ringo played with Harry Nilsson, his pseudonym that he used in that band was Richie Snare, which is great because if there's anything that's immediately identifiable as Ringo's drumming, it's that snare hit. You know, nobody else does it like he did. And because of what you just said, the instant gratification of the internet or anything else, can you imagine? The deal is that the drumming on Dear Prudence was Paul, and it's because that song, it's so obviously not Ringo on the drums, it's because that song was recorded in that two-week period in 1968 when Ringo said, fuck this, I'm out of here. And nobody knew. And can you imagine somebody quitting the biggest band in the world today for 2 weeks and nobody knew?
It's an amazing thing. You actually had something back then, for all intents and purposes, that mattered, called privacy.
Yep.
It doesn't, I mean, look, there were rumors, and that's what they were, rumors that maybe JFK had fucked around on Jackie, maybe with Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
Are you kidding? Can you imagine in this day and age, or if you had the web back then?
Yeah, it's just, there's a kind of insanity to living today. And, you know, it's a worry, I guess, especially for our kids and their kids, because we didn't grow up in it. You know, we didn't grow up in a world where you didn't have privacy. We had, if we wanted to get away, I mean, do you remember making a phone call to somebody? And when you called their house, if they weren't home, you just had to wait.
Yeah, an answering machine.
Yeah, right.
There wasn't an answering machine. There wasn't a system that if the phone itself rang, it would pick up and you could leave a voicemail. Like, you know, most modern phones now through the voice over IP have.
Right.
You know, it is a bit of it's a frightening thing. Look. Do you remember when you could go on vacation and not be called by work because nobody could find you?
Right. Well, yeah. And that's what I was getting to is my grandson just turned a year old and he will never be in a world where he's not contactable by anyone at any time.
Yeah. I mean, it's all well and good for us to be able to turn off our phones.
Right. But we don't.
It doesn't mean that somebody won't be callous enough to keep calling or emailing or texting
right.
for the most arcane and insane reasons.
And you know, that's another thing that seems to be going away is if I don't want to be contacted, don't call me again 15 minutes later. That idea that, oh, well, I can't get him on his cell phone. I better send him an email and I'll send him a text and I'll, you know, try and Skype him and I'll do all of these things. It's like, no, if I let the call go to voicemail, there's a reason.
File that one under no shit.
Yeah. Rob Ross, John Grayson, here it is, Radio City. Thank you so much for indulging us and listening into the podcast. And we're going to move on to some new music because there are some things that you've reviewed, Rob, for Popdos that we definitely want to get into. And the first one, boy, this one just hit every possible high note for me. And I'm going to leave it to you to pronounce the name of the band because I don't want to botch it. But once again, we have some good old-fashioned pop rock out from it's in the form of a song called Euphoria Love, but talk a little bit about this band.
Brenyama from New
Thank
Jersey.
You.
Yes. They are, in fact, one of the latest signings to Gem Records. They're a husband and wife duo, Maki and Richard Brenner, and this is their debut album. And one of the main things about them is that they're very good at melding together what I think everyone loves about 60s pop, especially around, let's say, between 66 and 68, before everybody either went extreme hippie and hard rock or got too psychedelic and drugged out for their own good. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, the Beatles, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, maybe Syd Barrett, the Kinks around Face to Face, something else from the Kinks, Bowie, while he was still doing that kind of finding his way
Yep.
feel. But then they also know that perfectly with the likes of the Ramones,
Modern English.
Modern English, and that early 80s. I'm not going to use the phrase new wave, but that the post-punk that we listened to on the radio and picked up on very quickly, the melodic structured pop sounds. And then for good measure, they've got the grittiness, but yet still the pop structured feel of something like a Matthew Sweet or a Teenage Fan Club.
Yeah, it's really nice. I mean,
It's
I can't say enough about it.
nice, and I also really like the production, which was actually done by Kurt Weill from the Gripweeds,
Nice. Okay.
who's basically a neighbor and label mate, you know. But I mean, to make it more all in the family, you know, Peter Horvath from the Anderson Council, you know, makes a couple of appearances on this album. But the thing is that, yep, this is an album filled with catchy pop songs.
Yeah. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned Peter Horvath as well, because not only is he a terrifically talented musician, he's one of the few who was able to put one over on me for a couple of years, and I felt so dumb when I finally got why his band is called the Anderson Council. It hit me, and I went, "Oh, right, Pink, yeah, Pink Anderson and Floyd Council. Right, okay, I got it now."
Really nice guy, really sharp sense of humor, great songwriter.
Definitely. Now
The disciple of Andy Partridge.
Yeah.
But this record, you know, it has that balance. And I think what I like about it is it does veer a little bit more towards the 60s side. The garagey side is what really drives it in that 60s way. And that's what I like so much about this record.
Yeah.
So this is one of those moments where a band has now made their debut. And let us hope that their next album will be just as good, if not better.
Yeah, I'm
You
sure it will.
never want a band to repeat themselves, but you want them to keep up the quality. And I'm not so sure I believe in the sophomore jinx anymore. I think that theory went out the window when REM released Reckoning. But some bands do tend to think about that notion because it always just hangs over bands in general. But let us hope.
You know what? And I'm going to stop and talk about REM here for a second, too, because I was considering this for my contribution to our In Our Head segment this week, but I'm going to go off in a different direction. However, I wanted to mention this because you and I have gone back and forth about where the sweet spot of REM is. And I maintain, for me, it's Fables of the Reconstruction. And it's Life's Rich Pageant is yours, right?
No. For me, well, see, here's the thing. As somebody who got into REM like the dick that I am, I got into them with Chronic Town.
Right, okay.
So I was there before I ever even heard the fucking band.
Yeah.
All because of that little. In fact, on next week's show, I'm going to read to you the piece from the Faces section because I have it. I actually have it. Okay? That moment when my head was turned and something was actually going to save me from the impending breakup of the Jam. But I think if I was going to keep the balance in a fair way, REM for me starts with Chronic Town and ends with Fables of the Reconstruction. Fables of the
Okay.
Reconstruction is the apex,
Yes.
okay? Because an album that seemingly everybody either decided to ignore or just didn't like or understand, I loved. Because of my very strange and deeply rooted love of the South, I got it. You know, and you go back and you listen to things like Kahootek, which is one of my absolute favorites by them,
Yep.
or Maps and Legends, or Green Grow the Rushes. I mean, they could have broken up right there and I would have been happy. Actually,
Right.
if they would have broken up right there, I would have been happy.
Yeah, and that's I'm with you. I feel that same way about it. But the one that hit me as the one throwback from Life's Rich Pageant that really still sounded like the magic that they had in that one was one that my phone picked out for me today, which is Fall on Me. By the sky and tell the sky and leave the sky and tell the sky. It was the backing vocals that really did it. And it's far from my favorite of theirs, but I got it when I listened to it, for the 1,001st time this morning.
Well, it's a great song. I mean, there's no way around that. I think part of my problem, and that's what I always look at it as, my problem with REM. I should write a column on this so you can have everything try to lynch me. But,
Yep.
by 86, okay, at that point, it's already 4 years, and you're starting to tire of a band. They sounded a little too radio friendly. Ironically, that wasn't the breakthrough album. It really should have been,
Yeah.
because I think it's a far superior record to Document, which I of course hate.
Yep, me too.
But that record, funny, you picked out a song that is one that is your kicker by them. For me, on that album, I'm gonna take a shot in the dark, actually, and for some stupid reason, I think Hyena is the one that really lives with me.
Okay.
And I'll only pick that because here's the asterisk. I first heard Hyena 2 years before it ever came out because they were doing it during the Reckoning tour.
Right.
So, and in fact, Hyena should have been on Fables of the Reconstruction, actually. So, I already had a taste for a song that had yet to appear. But having said that, there are some songs on that record that are pretty amazing. I mean, Cuyahoga is one. I Believe is another.
When I was young and full of grace and spirited a rattlesnake, when I was young and fever fell, my spirit, I will not tell. You're on your honor, not to tell. Change the difference between what you want and what you need. There's a key.
I actually do like Underneath the Bunker for whatever weird reason. And it's a great sounding album. Out of all the records they've released, I think Don Gaiman got them to sound better than anybody else.
No doubt. Yeah. Well, and we'll get back to a little bit of that in our heads thing, but mine is going to skew off from what we're going to talk about in just a couple of minutes with DW Dunphy. But there is one other new piece of music we wanted to go over this week because of a band called Lake. And this again is a completely different direction, but sometimes you need something that's going to knock you upside the head a little bit, and I think this one does. Talk about Lake.
Well, funnily enough, it's another band that's driven by a husband and wife duo,
Yep.
Ashley Erickson and Elijah Moore, and they formed this band actually 12 years ago in Olympia, Washington. I'm going to have to work off of what I wrote to really put it in apt phrasing, so I hope nobody minds. It's a collection of very humanistic songs that go into, lyrically speaking, the complications of, being a moral and spiritual being in a very hostile current world. And God knows the world's axis is definitely tilted in a very off-kilter manner.
Yep.
The thing is, within the darkness and the contemplative nature, and maybe at points ponderous form of lyricism, the music is light enough to buoy you up instead of bring you down.
Yep.
So it's that perfect balance of contradiction that you need. It's the yin and yang working together perfectly. But, case in point, you've got songs titled like Work With What You Got or Gone Against the Wind, But for me, there's a standout track called Over Slash Under, and it's got a really nice late 70s kind of rainy day feel because it's driven by a Fender Rhodes piano. And I hear a Fender Rhodes piano, I am thinking definitely circa 77, 78, 79.
Yeah.
Kick back, smoke a doobie, and, you know, hang out with your lady friend, drink some Lancers.
Yeah, and it, I mean, the vocal qualities on this are terrific. She sounds nice, and the thing is, there's a weird ethereal quality to the vocals that is almost, it's got a sort of a hypnotic tone to it that has a mechanistic quality, not masochistic, but mechanistic, a machine-like quality to it, and yet it's perfectly smooth. I don't know how else to describe it, but it really fits over top of both of those things that you just talked about, the happy music and the very dark kind of lyricism.
Which I think, you know, it's interesting because part of their, from what I was reading, part of their influences are that kind of early 80s, I don't want to call it, you know, synth, well, I guess you would say, because that's what we used to call it, synth pop.
Synth pop, sure.
So, you know, I think that that would be a fair assessment instead of trying to veer away from what is obvious. So by incorporating some of that and incorporating some of the slower grooves, the dance grooves that they have in there, which there are, it kind of reminded me of points of things like, and you and I talked about them not too long ago, 07 and Massive Attack.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of almost jazzy but program groove to it.
It's just a magazine.
But it works in the framework of an actual physical band. It's just there. It's there as dressing, not the driver behind the entire train.
Right, exactly. So, again, another one that you've definitely got to check out. So, Lake's new album reviewed up there on the page elsewhere at popdose.com. A couple of other things to get into, and we had in our sad goodbyes and fond farewells section this week, a guy that was never at the front of the band that bore his name, and yet Jay Giles put together a tremendous group of blues rock performers. And these guys, I unfortunately never got to see them live, but their shows were absolutely flat legendary.
The one and only Jay Giles.
Yeah.
Very sad indeed. A very surprising bump. Are they really surprising, especially in terms of age, you know, numeric age at this point? I don't think so. Plus the fact that we've already endured how many of these moments when we have to talk about somebody's passing over the last almost 2 years now.
Right.
But still, you know, it's a loss because the band was together. They were still touring. They were still performing. And they were still knocking people out left, right, and center. And I was lucky I got to see the Jay Giles Band once. I actually was turned on to them in the mid-70s, even though I really didn't have much of, you know, that deep of a knowledge, because my cousin had actually interviewed them. And these were the days when they were still on Atlantic Records. In fact, it was at a point when they decided to change the group very briefly, and I think they had one or two releases. They definitely had one where they went from being the Jay Giles Band to just being the Giles Band.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, they did change it. But he'd interviewed them, and it piqued my interest, and that's when I started to listen to them. And, of course, my favorite, which will always stay with me because the video certainly always made me laugh, is Love Stinks. Because it just says so much and so, you know, with such ease.
Right. And I've got to go with Musta Got Lost. And it's because of the story that Peter Wolf tells about that song. And I had a conversation with him, oh, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 years ago. And he said when the album came out, they had been performing Musta Got Lost forever. I mean, that song was probably 10 years old by the time it got to the live album. And that little spiel that he did at the beginning of that song was something that he just came up with on the fly that night. And it just came out of him as they were introing the song. But as soon as the record came out, the people in the audience at future concerts started expecting that. So he had no idea by that point what the hell he had said. He had to go back and listen to the live album and memorize and teach himself his own words in the intro to that tune.
Which is brilliant. Yeah. I'm sorry. I think that's a brilliant thing to have to be able to do.
Yep.
I can't conceive of expecting somebody to say something as part of a song's introduction, except maybe Paul Stanley.
Yeah.
Because Paul Stanley is the Chuck Norris of rock and roll.
Right.
You know, but, and he's always got a line because he's the rock and roll evangelist. And there's always a shtick that's probably done and rehearsed so well that it's the script that plays over and over in his head. But to have to go back and do that, that's just absolute genius.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a terrific little nothing, you know, just pop rock ditty. So, you know, I have a certain soft spot in my heart for those. But yeah, sad goodbye to Jay Giles. And at least now Peter Wolf won't have to, you know, talk about how he isn't Jay Giles and reassure people that he's still around. A couple of other quick things to make mention of. And D.W. Dunphy, we mentioned this a minute ago, has an article this week that you wanted to spotlight. And all of this talk about fake news, and it's coming from all directions. D.W. took on the mantle of fake bands. What's he got for us?
I love that. I absolutely love that he singled this whole concept out, because, and he even says it as his opening salvo, you know, I've always had an attraction to fictional bands.
Yep.
Now, you can say what you will about fictional bands in any context, but, you know, there are some fictional bands that made great music.
Yeah.
Well, now, he singles out as the gist of this article, Max Frost and the Stormtroopers from Wild in the Streets. Now, Shape of Things to Come is a great song. That's I mean, it's on Nuggets, so
right.
You know it's pure gold. And he brings up Stillwater, which, of course, I'm sure will give
from
us
Almost seven. Famous, yes.
And, of course, Spinal Tap. And he says the Ruddles, but I don't recall the Ruddles being a fake band.
No.
I mean, it's a typo. He meant to say the Beatles, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, after the Shea Stadium concert, named for Cuban guerrilla leader Shea Stadium, I think they solidified their place in rock and roll history.
Right. I mean, even though they you know, everybody, the Screaming Chords were waiting to meet them at JFK, they landed at LaGuardia.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are a couple of other fake bands that I was immediately, it came right to my mind, simply because it's a great topic, and I hope he's going to write more about these or do breakdowns on them.
Right.
The first that I thought of was the Carrie Nations from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yes.
Okay, which is one of the, I mean, if they weren't the softcore porn version of Josie and the Pussycats, I don't know where the inspiration came from.
Well, wait, you're making the case that Josie and the Pussycats weren't softcore porn, weren't they?
Well, for demented, listen, I had a thing for Betty Rubble, so, you know, but the songs that were in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls are absolutely classic.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I know it's a very fucked up movie.
Yes.
And the only way to watch it is if you are not inebriated, because if you are inebriated, it will do certain harm to you.
Yeah, you'll jump out a window.
Your psyche is going to be fucked forever.
Now, I want you to do me a favor. Okay, finish the story, but hang on to the other fake band, because that's where I want to go with the In Our Heads thing.
Okay. The other fake band, which was a massively rousing success, are the one-hit wonders.
Yes, the O-Needers.
Exactly, as in, I wonder whatever happened to the O-Needers. People said that movie was corny and it was twee, etc., etc., etc. I actually have watched it many, many times, and I think it is possibly one of the smartest, absolute labor of love. There's no question. And Tom Hanks wrote the incidental music that went with it, that fit from the opening music to the dentist's chair music.
Yeah.
Everything fits. He went for accuracy to capture a particular time. the music that's done by the Wonders or by the Chanterelles or by Freddie Fredrickson, they all hit the right notes
yep.
in every possible way. And guess what? They had a hit on the radio. That yeah. thing you do was a fucking hit.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know, it's such a great story. And I have a tendency on my own Facebook feed, just for fun, I'll throw up a line from a movie just to see if anybody responds. And to give you there was one time about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, I had just watched it, just watched That Thing You Do for about the 45th time. And I just put up young squires, and the thread went on for about 150 posts of people just, I mean, they grabbed onto it immediately. That thing has lasting, staying power like very few other movies about rock and roll have.
But the great thing is, you know, they were, that's, and of course, what's the biggest fake band of all time? The Monkees.
Yeah, right.
Who, of course, in this case, the four Pinocchios became real boys.
Yep.
But you had the Partridge Family right afterwards. You had the Archies. That's the ultimate fake band. You know, how many hit singles did the Archies have? And there was no band. And right. how many albums did they put out? I mean, my God.
And it was the Wrecking Crew. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bigger list than I think DW's got a lot of work cut out for him going forward.
Oh, without doubt. And so let me get into mine, and then we'll head into the In Our Heads thing, because it happened to be, even though we had the Life's Rich pageant conversation earlier, that my In Our Heads was kicked off by DW Dunphy's column about fake bands, because I want to say it was 1977. Forgive me if I'm off by a year in either direction, but there was a Christmas time where they showed back-to-back specials. One of them was the Rankin and Bass Hobbit, the animated version of the Hobbit that was only, I think, a half an hour long, but it was still wonderful. And they backed that up, and this was, I believe, on ABC. They backed it up with the Doonesbury Christmas special. And to the best of my knowledge, that's the only time the Doonesbury Christmas special ever aired. But I happened to catch it as a 7-year-old, and they made a couple of songs for that Christmas special that they credited to Jimmy Thudpucker and his orchestra. And both of them are outstanding.
Hello, yes, it's me. I heard you on the air. You spoke of foreign wars and how you used to care. I wouldn't want to hold you to words of way back when. Now is not so very far from there. Stop in the middle of your life for asking who came of age with youthful rage at me like. Stop in the middle of your life, take another look.
I mean, it's such an obscure and rare reference, but in my world of fake bands, Jimmy Thudpucker is right up there, man. The dude was a hell of a singer.
How about Jet Screamer?
Yeah.
Up, Orc, uh-uh.
Yeah.
One of the catchiest songs of all time.
Mm-hmm. And the Way Outs. I mean, you got the Way Outs on the Flintstones, so,
and
you know.
You've got Pebbles and Bam Bam doing Let the Sun Shine In.
Right. And of course, the Bo Brummel Stones, even though they were kind of real.
But still, I mean, it was Shinrock with Jimmy O'Neill Stone and the Bo Brummel Stones and, you know, Frantic Freddie Flintstone doing the Flintstone Flop.
Yes.
Come on. That is ingrained in my culture. Oh, wait a minute. What about Rock Roll?
Which one?
Remember Rock Roll? And rock is going to roll in town tonight in Bedrock.
Yes.
Twitch. When you get an itch, then you do the twitch in Bedrock. Twitch, twitch, yeah, yeah.
Twitch, twitch. Oh, man. That's one that will never die. Good old Ann Margrock.
And, of course, Jimmy Darroch.
Yep.
And, of course, what's his name? Stoney Curtis.
and Rock Quarry, who was Rock Hudson. So, and it goes on and on and on. Oh, too much. Well, we're going to end this one, this edition of Radio City. And of course, you're welcome to go around and kick around to every other column and all of the other sections here on popdose.com. But there is one other thing that happened this week, and it was just an absolute mess. Not to end on a low note, but man, if the Aaron Hernandez saga could have gotten any more sick and any more twisted, it did over the last 7 days. I have had no use for this guy. I have no use for the Patriots in general. But even aside from that, $40 million. You hand me $40 million, I will find a way to be good.
I don't even know what to make of it anymore. I mean, yeah, it's the end of a very sad and very ugly saga. And it is an interesting sidebar to think that when you think about very serious run-ins with the law, it seems to happen with NFL players more than anyone else.
Yep.
But I will not digress. You know, obviously he was somebody who just did not know how to control himself and thought he was invincible, that he basically continued with his very shitty ways, even with all the incredible success and then obviously a God-given talent for playing the game of football.
Sure.
That he managed to fuck it up and fuck it up beyond description. The fact that he was acquitted of two murders doesn't negate the fact that he was still found guilty of another. He killed three people.
Yep, his hand was in all three of those deaths.
Right. Am I going to shed a tear or try to be understanding or feel sorry for him committing suicide? No, I will not. Yes, it's a tragedy for his daughter. That's the only tragedy involving maybe his parents.
Yeah.
But this guy was obviously not worth the tax dollars that would have been invested in keeping him alive for the duration. And I don't believe they have the death penalty up in Massachusetts. So
no.
That, I could be wrong, but
He was in for life.
Right. So shed tears, no. And of course, now the story is getting even more bizarre and ugly with, you know, his lawyers wanting his name completely cleared and wanting to get the money, the insurance money that would be due to his family, because apparently in a certain time period, if you die while in prison, but you haven't been formally charged,
they can vacate the conviction.
Yeah. No. I'm sorry. He was not a good person, and it should be left at that. And by him taking the coward's way out, yeah, justice is served.
Yeah. And, you know, and what I said at the beginning, I don't want it misconstrued that I was saying, oh, I think money can fix everything or money can buy happiness, because that's not the case. When I said with $40 million, I'll find a way to be good. If you have that kind of ability, you have that kind of talent, and you have that kind of money at your disposal, and you're still having trouble, you can fucking get help.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Arrogance and ego and invincibility are a lethal combination on any given day. Whether you're a football player, whether you're a police officer, whether you're, you know, an average working schmuck, it's going to be a lethal combination. And obviously thought he knew it all. So there you go. Yep. You can close that book once and for all now. Hopefully.
Yeah, but we're going to close this one as well. But again, we'll be back next week with more information and more fun for you here on Radio City. Thank you again for listening to us. And Rob Ross, have a great week.
You too, brother. And stay well, okay?
Yeah.
I'll talk to you.
I give it my best shot. There is more to come, and so make sure that you kick around and find out what else is here online for you at popdose.com. A lot of great writers, a lot of terrific sections of the website, and always something extra to click on. Some music, some videos, so go enjoy it, and we'll see you next week.